Back on Downtown, it is 4:32. Our next guest on the program, a longtime writer for the Portland Press-Herald and the author of a wonderful new book on artist Robert Indiana called The Isolation Artist, Scandal, Deception, and the Last Days of Robert Indiana. We are thrilled to be joined this afternoon by Bob Keys. Bob, thank you so much for being with us.
Rich, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for inviting me. I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
Why Robert Indiana is the subject of your book?
Well, because he had a very interesting life in Maine, and I knew him for a number of years, and his death was sort of mysterious as well, and there was a big lawsuit associated with his death. And so I was writing about that story for the Press-Herald, and as I continued to report the story, it just occurred to me that this is a much bigger story than simply a story for the newspaper. And I began putting things together and decided, thanks to a suggestion of my book editor, that it would make a very good book. And so I took him up on that challenge.
Well, I knew a little bit of the Robert Indiana story, but not a lot of the details. And man, this book read like a well-written detective novel. There is everything in it, from a wonderful and interesting cast of characters to suspicions of forgery, the deception that you mentioned in the title, and then mystery not just about the cause of death, but even when Robert Indiana died. As you write, the last years of his life are murky, and that seems to be pretty consistent with much of his life story.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly right. And it's a very good summation of a summary of both the book and of his life. He came to Maine in the late 1970s from New York by way of Indiana. And he came to Maine with a bit of a chip on his shoulder. I love your intro music. You know, he made the piece Love, L-O-V-E, with the tilted O and two letters over each other. And he made that piece in the 1960s, but never benefited from it in a financial sense. And while the piece itself gained a lot of recognition and widespread exposure, Indiana himself always remained a little bit less known than the piece itself, and that created some resentment, and that resentment expressed itself in anger, and he moved to Maine somewhat of an angry and bitter man in the late 1970s, and some of the things that plagued him in New York followed him into Maine, and love became a piece that defined his life and career, but he was so much more than that. And he spent his life in Maine fighting some of the demons that he inherited from New York, and his time in Maine was marked by some very peaceful years as well as some very controversial years, and then as you use the word murky, and that is a perfect way to describe his final years. There's a lot of intrigue around how he lived his final years, involving both the work that we know he made legitimately, the work he might have endorsed casually, and work that he definitely hadn't, or I shouldn't say definitely, but likely had very little to do with.
I thought it was very interesting to learn in your book, too, that he was not crazy about being lumped into that pop art world with people like Andy Warhol and Lichtenstein.
No, he didn't like that at all. He believed that his work had a noble cause, and he wanted to cast his work in marble and bronze and whatnot because he wanted to make sure it lasted forever. He didn't see himself as a pop artist. He saw himself as an artist who had something more significant to say and something that would outlast whatever trends of the art world might be. And he was right about that, actually. He absolutely created work that outlasted whatever trends might have existed in the 1960s and 70s, and that's one of the reasons we're still talking about it.
He ended up coming to Vinyl Haven and settling into an old meeting hall, the Star of Hope. Did that building turn out to be a pretty good metaphor for his life?
Oh, well, no question about that. He came to Maine, as you noted, in the late 1970s, because the Star of Hope was this huge place. It was a large three-story building, and he had been displaced from his studios and his homes in New York at least twice in the 1960s and early 1970s. And after a very disruptive youth in Indiana, he lived in 21 homes in the first 17 years of his life. He had no opportunity to put down roots or establish any semblance of a belonging. Maine offered that to him, not only just Maine, but an island in Maine, and not only just an island in Maine, but a large building that was arguably the largest building on the island, or one of the biggest buildings on the island. And he inhabited it entirely with his personality and his artwork, and it became absolutely the thing he wanted most of all, which was a place where he could make a lasting expression of himself and his art. And that is what it offered him, and that was both a challenge and also a reward of his life in Maine. And he spent 40 years here, both achieving that dream and then watching it crumble around him.
We're talking with Bob Keys here on Downtown. Relations with the locals were certainly strained at times. They didn't quite know what to make of Robert Indiana, and then all that made worse by the lawsuits and by reports of sexual indiscretions.
Yes, though the reports of the sexual indiscretions surfaced in the early 1990s, and that was his first foray of a lot of conflict and tension, at least in a public way, during his time in Maine. Again, he got here in 1970, and he tried to fit in the early years, and he created work somewhat quietly and then had started to have some shows. But in 1992, he was charged with having sex with young boys on the island, and he faced trial in Rockland on the mainland in 1993 and was acquitted of a single charge. He originally faced three charges. Two were dismissed. He was acquitted of the third. And he went back to the island, but faced the scorn. I don't think there's any other way to describe it, of the people who lived on the island who believed he was guilty. And he lived with the assumption of guilt from that moment on. And while some of his legal troubles ended in the courts in 1993, they persisted in other ways. He had troubles with the tax assessors, and he didn't pay his taxes, or didn't pay a large portion of his taxes for many years after those sex charges surfaced. And he got into trouble with the Maine Revenue Service at various times in his life, and he lived with this bit of an aura of legal. A legal cloud over him for many, many years, unfortunately, in Maine, from the early 1990s until 2016, when this large civil suit was filed against him by his art dealer in the Southern District of New York.
There are so many interesting characters that come into Robert Indiana's life, and I want to talk about a few of them. First of all, the relationship with Simon, I hope I say the name right, the Salama Caro and the Morgan Art Foundation that, on the one hand, helped him get some money for some of those earlier works, but then, like a lot of those relationships, it went south.
Yes, that's again, very, very good summary of the circumstances, at least as I understand them. Yes, Simon Salamacaro, you did a very good job with his name. Simon Salamacaro became a fan of Robert Indiana in the 1980s. He was an art gallery owner, dealer in London, and had become reacquainted or acquainted with Indiana's work and had expressed an interest in working with him. And for many years, and for quite a while, Indiana rebuffed those offers or those attempts to do business with him. But eventually, Simon Salamacaro persisted, and Robert Indiana agreed to work with him in a business sense. And they did a show together that was met with some success from Robert Indiana's perspective. I'm not sure if Simon would agree financially, but it created a relationship between them that proved fruitful to both. And ultimately, this led to a series of contracts in the late 1990s, which, as you noted, helped Robert Indiana out of his tax issues with the state of Maine and allowed him to reestablish his career after a very dark period in the 1990s and become again an internationally known artist with exhibitions not only in Maine and across the country, but internationally as well. Simon Salmacaro promised Robert Indiana that if he would do business with him, he would reestablish his presence as an international artist. And everything that Simon promised, he delivered. So that was the foundation of their relationship in the late 1990s.
And then another relationship that proved to be financially successful was working with Michael McKenzie, who paid him $1 million a year to do the Hope artwork, which became a representation of the Obama campaign and presidency. It led to a late career boom, but then also as a result of that were other Indiana works that maybe weren't Indiana works, including one for Johnsonville Sausage.
Yeah, Brat, B-R-A-T. B-R-A-T, you know, two letters over each with the tilted R. Yes, that was the last piece that was associated with Robert Indiana, and from my reporting, Indiana got him received personally about $230,000 or so for Brat. The question is whether he knew anything about it or had anything to do with it. Michael McKenzie, as you noted, began working with Robert Indiana. He reestablished a relationship with Robert Indiana in 2008 with the piece Hope. And that became associated with the Obama campaign. He had done work with Indiana before, had known him for many years. And he promised Indiana, as Simon Salmacaro had promised Indiana, that he would help reestablish his career in other ways. And Hope delivered for Indiana exactly what Michael McKenzie said it would do. But in so doing, Michael McKenzie became in direct conflict with Simon Salmacaro and the Morgan Art Foundation. So Simon Salmacaro represented Indiana in the international art market, and he also advised the Morgan Art Foundation. And so he had a complicated relationship with both of those entities and sort of lived in this murky middle world. And Michael McKenzie was very much committed to Indiana and contemporary work, Hope and others as well. That obviously created the conflict, and that's where that lawsuit in 2016 came from between those two art dealers.
And then two other people who weave their way into this story in fascinating ways. Sean Hillgrove, who worked as a longtime assistant, who late in Robert Indiana's life was pretty much cut out of his life because he was concerned that there was some kind of elder abuse going on. And then Jamie Thomas, who ended up as his assistant and who, depending on who you talk with on the island, was either a hero or a villain.
Yeah, correct. Great characterization. Yeah, Sean Hillgrove became involved with Robert Indiana because he knew the martial arts, and Robert Indiana wanted a bodyguard. He had been held up in New York and felt vulnerable, and he had read about Sean Hillgrove in the local paper and wanted a bodyguard, and so he engaged his services, and they became very, very close. Some would say like father and son. In fact, they were together on 9/11 in New York, and had lived through that experience in New York and came back to Vinyl Haven closer than ever before. And Sean Hillgrove was among the people who were forced out of Indiana's life in the last few years by, according to court documents filed by the Morgan Art Foundation, by Jamie Thomas, who lives on Vinyl Haven and had known Indiana for many years and was hired as Indiana's late-in-life caretaker and hired to do many things, among others, help him in the studio and help him with his meals and help him be comfortable in his old age. And in that process, Sean Hillgrove, who again had been like a son to Indiana by many accounts, was forced out of Indiana's life and reported abuse to Indiana to the Department of Health and Human Services, and foresaw much of what we learned in the court case later might have happened to Indiana in terms of him being isolated and not allowed to have contact with the outside world.
Now, your first meeting, I believe, with Robert Indiana was in 2002. You found him to be extremely charming in that first meeting. You talked to him a number of times through the years. Were you surprised when somebody who had liked dealing with some members of the media sort of disappeared from public view?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I lost contact with Indiana approximately 2016. He had a show at Bates College of Art with work about Bob Dylan, and I'm a big Bob Dylan fan, and I wanted to learn more about that work. And Michael McKenzie had approached me about doing a story about that exhibition, and I was immediately interested. Indiana had always talked to me about his artwork, but this was the first time he said no. Well, he didn't say no. Michael McKenzie said he wasn't available to talk about it. He said he was feeling his age. He wasn't that he was ill, but he just wasn't up for interviews anymore, that he wanted to concentrate his energies on his artwork. Which sounded a little bit dubious to me, only because Indiana was a great promoter of his work. I had always had, thanks to his publicist, Kathleen Rogers and Ellsworth, I had always had great access to Indiana. And at this point, Kathleen wasn't involved anymore. All of a sudden, Michael McKenzie was the gatekeeper, and I had no longer had access. So that made me a little bit suspicious. And as I learned a few years later, that was the beginning of the moment when Indiana had changed his will and become isolated, and Michael McKenzie and Jamie Thomas became larger players in his life.
And you mentioned Kathleen Rogers. That's one of the saddest parts of the story for me, is reading what happened and some of the things she went through, especially when she tried to get Robert Indiana together with Mick Jagger's daughter, Jade.
Yes, exactly. So Kathleen Rogers became Robert Indiana's publicist in the late 1990s and remained his publicist up to the point where, as with Sean Hillgrove, she was forced out of his life in and around 2014, 2015, and certainly by 2016. She had the opportunity to connect Robert Indiana with Jade Jagger, who was a jewelry designer. And Indiana had always envisioned himself as a designer of things, I mean, artwork and otherwise, for rock stars and whatnot. And Kathleen had arranged the opportunity, perhaps, to do a deal. And a representative of Jade Jagger's arrived on Vinyl Haven with the idea that she was going to have a meeting with Indiana. And the morning of the meeting, it was called off. Jamie Thomas came out of the Star of Hope and told Kathleen that Indiana wasn't up for the meeting and that they would have to wait at least another day. And things deteriorated from there, and the meeting never happened. And again, that was a sign to Kathleen that things weren't right. And it was unfortunately one of a few things that had happened in a period of maybe 18 or 20 months where Indiana, who had always been able to, you know, speak for himself and do things, suddenly became less accessible, and deals fell through. And that was a big loss in many ways for Indiana and the opportunity that might have been for his artwork.
Well, it is an absolutely fascinating story. It is so tremendously well researched, and I think, Bob, what I like best about it is that the ending is ambiguous. We don't know for sure who the good guys and the bad guys are. There are no black and whites. There are a lot of grays in this book, and that to me is what helps make it such a fascinating story.
Yeah, yes, exactly. There are a lot of still unanswered questions. And the book tells people that, again, you use the word murky. It's a very murky story. And this sort of connects some of the threads and whatnot. But it also allows a lot of opportunity for people to interpret what might have happened and what we still might learn.
The book is called The Isolation Artist: Scandal, Deception, and the Last Days of Robert Indiana. It is a wonderful read. Bob Keyes, it's great to get a chance to talk with you. I've enjoyed your work for many, many years, and the book is just wonderful.
I say the same about your work, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. Thank you, Rich.
Thank you, Bob.